All right, good afternoon. Thanks for showing up. There's a lot of good sessions going on right now, so I'm pretty thankful you guys chose to attend. You could be at any session you want to right now, so thanks for coming to this one. My goal today is to talk a little bit about racing, talk a little bit about Hendrick Motorsports, give you some background, and then show you how we use Azure on a day-to-day basis to compete every weekend, to win, and to kind of give you an idea on what we've implemented over the last year. My name is David Hood. I'm an engineer slash data scientist with Hendrick. We wear many hats, so I actually have a mechanical engineering degree and got involved in racing. Got involved with programming the side of racing and then the data science side. So we've come a long way in probably the last 10 years in terms of racing and data, and I'll touch on a few of those reasons why we kind of had this explosion of data the last couple years. As I'm talking, if you have a question, let's go ahead and address it then, as long as we don't get too many, and then we'll do a Q&A session afterward as well. If you have some follow-up questions, go with that. So a little bit about the idea with Microsoft and Hendrick. About a year ago, Microsoft was looking to get involved with the sport as a whole, and that involves being involved with NASCAR proper and then being involved with a NASCAR team. And the way NASCAR is laid out, you really need both those, because if you have NASCAR proper, you don't have access to the driver. If you have the NASCAR team, you don't have access to NASCAR as a whole. So they're kind of separate entities. So Microsoft came to us and said, hey, we're kind of shopping around for a team to go with. Give us a spiel. So we told them about our past history and things we do and the amount of drivers we have. And long story short, they said, hey, we'd like to partnership with you. And that was about a year ago. During that year time, we've seen an explosion in growth of our offerings that we put up in Azure. We have ASP.NET applications, WPF applications, a lot of data science and machine learning aspects in the cloud, high performance computing, storage and media archive. And I'll touch on a lot of things we use in the Azure cloud, and we can go into a little bit more detail, but that kind of gives you a background on how we got going with Microsoft, and you'll be able to see that progression basically a year later from where we currently are. So as you dive in and look at the concept of Hendrick Motorsports, we're an organization that's been around over 30 years, a professional organization that races four full-time teams in the Cup Series, and we support a majority of the Chevrolet teams in the Cup Series. So the engine program for Hendrick Motorsports supplies actually 25% of all the engines in the NASCAR series. So if it's a Chevrolet, unless it's a Childress car, we basically provide the power plant for that vehicle. We do a lot of development work in our chassis as well and supply those as a lease deal or rentals basically to other teams. And some of these stats are a little bit outdated. When this says more than 200 race victories, I think we're close to 250. So we average about 8 to 9 wins per season. And we have 11 championships, so we've had a pretty good run. So about every 3 years, we're bringing home a championship, give or take. So, and we did have a stretch where we won 6 in a row, or 5 in a row, so that definitely does help things. But our drivers are currently Casey Kane, Chase Elliott, Jimmy Johnson, Dale Earnhardt, and we are based in Charlotte, North Carolina, actually Concord, which is right near the Charlotte Motor Speedway, if you know where that's at. So, first thing I'd like to go into is talk about a few of the problems we face and how we address them with Azure. And these problems might be a little bit different than what you might be up against in your particular domain, but there's probably some takeaways here that might give you some ideas to think about, or maybe it can spawn some other questions from that aspect. I put up this graph because I want you to see one of the things we do at the track is we try to tune on the race car, because you got to think a race car is an entity, a mechanical entity, that when it's on the track at 200 miles an hour, it's in a different form and shape than it is sitting still. And the sides of the race car and the suspension of the race car are meant to compress and transform and change under aerodynamic load. So a lot of times the side of the race car will oil can or change shape because it's got aerodynamic load on it, and it'll actually bow in. The suspension compresses to the point that there might be a 3-inch gap in front of the car when it's sitting still, but when it's under 200 mile an hour load, it's maybe a 1/4 inch or even dragging the ground. So one of the ways we try to get a handle on how our car, the attitude of our car during the actual event, is we have photographers spaced around the track, and their job is to shoot high-speed photos. So they basically put on burst and they hold down the button. I think they get paid by the photo, basically. So they put the camera on burst mode, and they take photos of our cars and other teams' cars around the track at various corners. And then they push those photos up to a track server, and then our team consumes those photos. And the idea is they're going to look at a photo, a still photo of the car under a dynamic condition, to see the attitude of the car. And they're wanting to be able to tell small details of the car, like how far is the splitter from the ground, what is the roll and yaw angle of that car, how sealed up it is along the side of the car. And we'll talk about some of these details so you'll know a little bit more what I'm talking about if you're not familiar with NASCAR. But the idea is that you can't look at the car statically sitting in the garage and know that's what it looks like on the track. So to get around that problem, we take a lot of photos. And so I put this graph up so you can see how many photos we actually look at. And so this graph dates all the way back to 2013. And this is projected. Our season's not over yet. We have about 8 races left. But you can see our number of actual photos. This is, when I say number of files, it's number of photos taken at the track. So over 36 races, that's 520,000 photos. So these guys are averaging about 10 to 11 to 12,000 photos a weekend. It's what GM specs out. So those guys will get there at the track. They'll have their Wi-Fi enabled, Canon EOS or some kind of Nikon professional camera. They'll put on burst mode. They'll take shots of all the cars coming in the corner, and they'll pump those photos up to a local server. Now, that's all great until you say, well, okay, in that 11,000 photos, show me photos of the 24 car. And so you open up the Windows Explorer, and you start dragging through, and you're hoping that your eye will catch a paint scheme that you recognize. And some paint schemes are very recognizable. Some of them are not. They're kind of more vague in terms of really sticking out to your eye. But the general thumb is you scroll through those photos and you try to find a photo of your car at a particular attitude that you care about. And then you say, well, who else is fast that practice? And it might be the 18 car, or maybe it's another car of ours, 48. And what you might want to do is say, well, what is his attitude compared to my attitude in turn three? So in those 11,000 photos, find me the 24 car and find me the 48 car at an isometric angle in turn three. It's kind of hard to do. I mean, we have 600 people that work in Henry Motorsports, and if we put every single one of them on looking at 12,000 photos, we wouldn't have time to do anything else. So we kind of have that issue, and we've got a unique way of kind of solving that. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail on that. One of the things we ran into, too, is we've also downsized the size of our photo. We asked those guys to scale back on the resolution of their camera. It was just taking too long to get the photo from the camera to the network drive to the user's computer. We probably have 20 people looking at these photos. So you imagine 20 people trying to consume those photographs. When your file size is 2-3 megabytes, it just doesn't work out too well. So our file size has gone down, and the number of photos has gone way up. So that's a problem we face. We start looking about how to get around that. Let's talk about the actual implementation and details of how we solve the issue of having 10,000 photos a weekend and consuming those. So we call this the image recognition photo application, and Microsoft helped us develop a lot of this. The idea is that we're going to take a known entity we're working with, which is a track. We all kind of know the track pretty well. And so to give you a little bit of background in terms of the track, this is actually Martinsville. They call it a paperclip because it looks like a paperclip. It's about a half a mile around. And when you start looking at this track, you can break it down. So you've got basically the base image of the track, and then you can start categorizing the areas of the track that you care about. Because you can make the car handle good in turn one or two, but if it's not handling good in turn three or four, you've got a problem. And the turns are different enough, it's not a gross assumption that a car handling turn one automatically handles in all four corners. So you would have setups that are geared more towards different corners in the track. More corners might be a little bit more difficult to navigate for a particular driver. Maybe Jimmy's really good in turn three and four, and Chase is good in turn one and two. So what you try to do is make Chase feel more comfortable in turn three and four, maybe make Jimmy feel more comfortable in one and two. So that brings up another problem. Now you're not only looking for photos of the 24 car, you're looking for photos for the 24 car in turn one and two when Chase is having problems. So you're trying to find that needle in a haystack of 10,000 photos that will give you what you need to know of the 24 car, say just in this turn one. So we take the track and we break it down into these six sections. And then we take these six sections and basically number them, per se, to get an idea of where the car is so that when we communicate, we're all talking the same lingo. So we'll give these areas of the track of numbers. This is turn one and two. This is the back stretch. Turn three and four in the front stretch. So it's pretty common terminology amongst all the people that work on the car. And the idea is we'd like to be able to go to these 10,000 photos and have them sorted, so that we can say, hey, show me all the photos of the backstretch, and it just populates all the photos on the right-hand side that shows you all the photos of cars on the backstretch. Because one of the things we know is where the photographer is, and we know kind of his angle he's gonna take of the car. With a car running at Martinsville, probably about 100 miles an hour, he's not gonna get a chance, if he's close to the track, to take a photo of the car coming at him, and then pan as the car leaves and then take a photo of the rear. He's gonna set his camera up basically in one orientation and snap high burst photos. So you know if he's on the backstretch, you're probably going to get about the same photo every time. And as we look at some of these photos, pay attention to how close they are in terms of position and translation down the track. They actually do a really good job of taking about the same shot of different cars at the same location on the track. So the idea is that you click on one of these photos and pull up that particular car. So this is the 88 car. to kind of talk about some of the things we care about with the car. This is on the front of the car, it's called the splitter, and the idea is that you want that splitter as close to the ground as possible without hitting the ground. If the splitter rubs the ground, it ends up unloading the front of the suspension, and the driver gets this kind of quasi-feel where he doesn't feel real stable in the car, and he'll complain about the front end bouncing and he's not able to turn like he wants to. This area here on the side is called the side skirt, and aerodynamically, you'd like that side skirt to be as close to the ground as possible so air can't flow underneath it. The problem is, as I said before, the car in its static condition might show a 3-inch gap in the front and a 5-inch gap in the back. But then under aerodynamic load, you'd like for that gap to basically close up to zero. And when they say, is the car sealed up? They're saying, is there a large air gap between the front splitter in the ground and the side of the car in the ground? So we use these photos to get an idea for what the suspension looks like under aero load. In this case, they might take some spring load out of the front right to bring that part of the splitter down. But you can't just look at the car when you take the spring load out and say, okay, we fixed it. You have to go back out, take more photos, then assess and get that feedback. So our feedback basically is photographs of the car on the track. That'd be nice if NASCAR gave us the opportunity to use data and telemetry data of the car while it's on the track to see what that wheel suspension travel is. But in the rules, that's not an option. So you have to find ways around the rules, and one of the ways is photographs. So look at a little bit more detail. There's a couple other areas of the car that you care about, especially when you talk about a competitor's car. The back quarter panel of the car and its shape under aerodynamic load will change. So that's what I was talking about. The panels are flexible enough that air pushing on the car would actually cause that panel to maybe cave in a little bit. And some teams are a little bit more versed at allowing that transformation during the car actually under aerodynamic load. The splitter here and some of the orientation and some of the orientation of the hood and even the front, the way that the side panels are in the car, you're just looking for any small detail aerodynamically between you and a competitor that might equate to 0.05 of a second or 0.1 of a second. We're not talking about 2 or 3 seconds here. It's usually in the 0.01 of a second. So a little detail goes a long way in trying to determine what's different between my car versus his car. Is the fast competitor on the car sealed up better in this particular area? Does that matter at this track because it's 0.5 mile? Is the splitter more important? We don't really know, so we're iterating as we go, and our feedback means is dynamic photographs. But the problem is 10,000 photographs, it's hard to get the feedback item you want out of that amount. So one of the ways we ran around that is we said, hey, can we develop an application that will allow us to look at photographs and query photographs and really reduce the amount of photographs we want down to the select few? Because out of the 10,000, these guys shoot photographs of all things. Fire trucks, ladies at the track, I guess they find attractive. competitors' cars that aren't really competitors in terms of actually being fast that weekend. Let's say that 60% of the photos are photos you just don't care about. So you're going to throw away 60 to 80% of those photos. It's even more difficult to find that 20% that are really going to add value. But you can't ask the photographer, say, hey, just don't take photographs of that car. That's a little bit difficult in the heat of the moment. His job is to take photos and push them up, and then it's on us to reduce them. So when you start talking about queries, one of the things we might care about is side shots of cars in comparison. So this is the 4 car and the 24 car. And when I said pay attention to the photographer and how he shoots his photos, these are definitely different photos of different cars, but look at the relationship between the shadow on the track and the car in both these photos. They're actually almost at the exact same spot. So when he puts his own camera on burst mode and he takes that photo, they're actually really good at getting almost the exact same shot for different cars, so you can almost overlay the photos and see really quickly, what does his car look like in this particular area under dynamic load versus ours? What is his front splitter orientation respected to his? And you've actually got a pretty good shot in comparison between a really fast competitor on the track and maybe our car that's not very fast or close, but not quite where we need to be. Maybe we're faster than him and we want to make sure we don't go the opposite direction and get slow. We might look at a car that's right under us and say, all right, what is his suspension geometry look like? This is a good comparison because a little bit of background on this 4 car, it's a car that races with Stuart Haas Racing. And we provide the engines for those guys and chassis and even engineering support. So they run a lot of the components we run, even though they're a completely separate team. We share a lot of the same common components. So you can learn from these guys, even though they might not tell you exactly what they're doing. Our goal is to take photographs and try to deduce some of the things they might have found or some of the areas they might be a little bit better or not quite as good as us. We're basically comparing ourselves to everyone else. Racing is a unique sport because you're not out to beat one competitor. You have to beat 42 other people. But the nice thing is you just have to beat everybody else and you win the whole thing. So from our standpoint, we do this constant comparison between other teams to see who's fast, who's not. What do we need to change? Was that good or was that bad? And then we'll look at our own car as well as it travels through the corner and what its suspension does in particular corners. And a lot of the suspension is kind of dynamic in terms of its orientation. There's a big thing in the sport where a couple years ago, the suspension would actually skew and move around in the corner. So it had this dynamic aspect to it. And so you're looking for any of that detail in photographs, because once that car pulls into the garage and they're not driving anymore, it's really not the same car. And so you can look all day at that static car if you want, and you're not going to get the information you're going to get out, like it was an under load.
Are there rules limiting triggering that picture at the same time every time your car goes by?
Are there rules to do that, like automation?
So why is your phone trying to time the picture or having the photographer do it at the same time? Can you do it automatically?
No, their photographer's actually holding down the button, so it's not automatic capture. NASCAR does have some rules in place where you can take photographs and use still photography, but video is off limits. So you really have to, I guess you could automate the photo capture at a particular time, but it's difficult to know. The cars don't go out at a particular instant. And so I think it'd be hard to sync up where that car is GPS position-wise on the track to where you want to take that photo of that car, because we don't have access to the telemetry of the GPS data either. So you really just know our car's coming down the backstretch. He puts his, I mean, I've curated these photos so they are close to one another. So of that four car, he might have shot seven photos, and then we curate out the three that are comparable to our three. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So the idea, too, is looking at some of these cars in a close-up view. This is the front stretch at Texas. This is one of our cars, the five car. You can kind of see the gap along the front and the orientation of the car with respect to the ground. We'll slide over to another photo here. This is a competitor car, the 11 car. You can start to look here and too at what his body shape looks like, how far he is from the ground to his side skirt, maybe the rear quarter panel to the ground, the relative position of the wheel with respect to the outer body in the front and rear, even the shape of the grill, how much tape they have on the grill, his gap along the front. A picture's worth 1,000 words, and for us, this is a dynamic picture, which is worth 1,000 words that you can't get statically. So we really do depend on these photos a lot, and that's why they take so many of them. So we've kind of created our own problem. We want a lot of photos. We want you guys to take a lot of photos. Man, you did a great job. Now what? So to kind of get down to where we're at from this standpoint, I think I've laid the groundwork that we have an issue with photos and that we have a desire and a need to compare our car versus another competitor that might be fast for the weekend. The problem arises in we have so many photos. What do we do about that? We also like to be able to come in and automatically lay out certain aspects of the car that would be nice to know in terms of a dimensional standpoint. So I've highlighted here maybe the angle of the splitter with respect to the ground, picking up a reference point on the splitter, the position of the rear quarter panel with respect to the side skirt, with respect to the ground, and then the ride height of the rear of the car. The splitter is a big aerodynamic dam on the back of the car that provides a lot of drag. And so there's been some work in the past to try to get that splitter out of the air when you're going down the straightaway, when you don't want a lot of drag, but then in the corner, when you need the car to handle and settle, you want that splitter to then become effective. So you'll try to tweak the rear suspension so that the splitter will change its relationship with respect to airflow, depending on straightaway or corner. And so that's one of the things you look at is what is the travel of the height of that rear splitter off the ground on the backstretch where you're reaching your maximum speed. So when you talk about the application in terms of Microsoft, it's an image recognition software that lives in the cloud. The photos end up getting pushed to a local server that ends up getting offloaded to a machine learning algorithm that tries to deduce what is the car number of this particular photo, and then it gets binned or categorized so that teams can consume and curate those photos that have been categorized already. Now, a good question is how accurate is the model and how well does it do at categorizing 10,000 photos? And so there's two numbers here, the 90 and the 60. 90 is a really good weekend. Go ahead.
All teams have access to that same software?
All four of our teams do. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, yes, a competitive advantage from our standpoint.
Do other teams use similar things?
Not that I'm aware of. They may, but... So in terms of accuracy, this is a model living in Azure that we push a photo through a REST API. It categorizes it and then gives us basically metadata pushback to a database. So when we pull those photos down, we know if they've already been categorized in the confidence interval. So a lot of times the machine learning algorithm will give you a confidence interval. On a good weekend, this thing's 90% accurate. On a bad weekend, it's 50 to 60. And there's a couple reasons why you see that big spread. So when we talk about some of the reasons and things we run into in terms of the 60%, there's a few things that can kind of hose things up for you. One, when you take a photo of a car, there's no guarantee you're getting a solitary photo of one car. And so you can imagine from this aspect, if you say, hey, machine learning algorithm, give me an idea of which car is in this photo, it says, there's a lot of cars in the photo. I don't really have a good shot of them. And from a machine learning algorithm standpoint, photos like this are difficult to get an answer on because you don't have this clear bounding box around the car. And from a computer vision standpoint, it's hard to tell where the 5 car ends and the 21 car begins, because a lot of times we train the model on maybe a full-blown shot of the 21, and this is like a clip shot. So, you know, it doesn't even really actually look like this the same car you've trained on. In fact, you could almost argue that from a computer AI standpoint, I'm not even sure that's a car, because it's got this overlay to it and it's multiple images of the car. So that's one of the reasons we run into a degradation in accuracy is you might have a photo of a ton of cars and you're just not sure which one it is. The algorithm just doesn't really know, and it can't, with a high confidence, say, yes, this is a car that I care about. You might also have cars on the edge. So this is where the photograph actually has a car that was maybe halfway, 50% in the view. In this case, it's gonna be difficult to deduce what car number that is. The nice thing about that is that's a photo where it was miscategorized or not categorized at all, and it's not useful. So for us, I know that's the 41 car. There's not much you can deduce from the 41 car from that photo, so we're okay if we don't quite get that accuracy. For the 21 car here, though, that's a pretty good shot. For our 5 car, that's one of our cars, you're missing the whole front clip, so maybe you want to just discard that car because you know it's not going to be relevant for what you care about. So we're kind of okay with this one as far as cars off the side. And then the last time is you have this high contrast where if you can't deduce the paint scheme on the car because there's too much glare, then you can bet a machine learning algorithm is going to be able to deduce the paint scheme on the car. And so when you look at this car and say, well, what paint scheme is that? I know it's the Nationwide 88 car, but the casual observer might look at it and say, I'm not sure what number that is. It's very difficult to determine that's the 88 car. And likewise, the car beside it, I think that's the 42. But I'm even not sure. I mean, to see barely an idea on the 4, you can imagine this scenario that machine learning isn't going to be able to tell, oh, that's the 42 car. I got you. And so you do have an area where your success rate of categorization goes down for those three main reasons. The last one that you have degradation and image recognition is the paint scheme changes. And so I brought these up because this is a great example. This 48 car on the right was a car Jimmy won in California this past year with. It's a Superman car. And so they did a big push with DC Comics and when they're coming out with Batman Superman. And so what we'll do is we'll train the model on the 48 car, and you basically feed it a bunch of existing photos of the 48 car. And then you say, okay, this weekend I want you to tell me which cars are the 48 car, and it's never seen the Superman paint scheme, so it doesn't know to equate the Superman car with the 48 car. So we do run into this issue because in NASCAR a lot of times you have multiple paint schemes. The 48 car, not so much. He's pretty solid in his low sponsorship. But there are a lot of teams in NASCAR that might have 3 or 4 or 5 primary sponsors. And based on that, when they changed the paint scheme, or another instance, like for Darlington, was what they call throwback weekend. It was a lot of paint schemes from maybe 20 years ago. You haven't trained the model on those old throwback paint schemes because a lot of times you don't even know that paint scheme until the week of the event. And so you get an accuracy reduction based on that. And a lot of times when they do change the paint scheme on you, you might know statically what the paint scheme is going to look like from a side and a top view because they've designed it digitally, but you don't have the isometric shot or the front shot that you need to really use for image recognition. So you'll have to burn 1 or 2 practices to get those photos that you need and manually retrain the model so that you now have that algorithm trained on the new paint scheme at different orientation. So there's just some things we run into from the photo app. Like I say, we have a solution in place that does categorize photos and allows the guys at the track to look at curated photos that have been categorized for the teams they care about, and works pretty well. So we're pretty happy with our solution. There's still some work to do, and there are some things that I touched on that we run into, But overall, it does take the manual input and work of 10,000 photos and reduce that down drastically. So it's been a positive move, and all that's running Azure. So we've had a pretty good experience with that. Kind of moving on to the next thing I want to talk about. If you guys are familiar with NASCAR, there's a lot of data generated in NASCAR. And so I put up a sample of that data. This blue speed trace, or this blue trace, is actually the RPM of the engine. You can equate that to speed because for all intents and purposes, there's not a lot of wheel slip during a wide open lap. So think of this blue basically as speed of the car. Red at this point is throttle input, so that's driver input to the gas pedal. And then green here, I believe, is fuel pressure. So what you basically see is when the driver's off the gas, so this means he's 0% throttle, fuel pressure kind of builds back up because you're not consuming that much fuel. There's bypass in the car. And when he gets back in the gas, this is throttle growing from 0 to 100%. As your speed goes up as well, fuel pressure goes down. I throw this graph up here because I want you to see that this is actual data from a race event. We collect data on the car at 100 hertz. So you're looking at 60 data points per second. A typical NASCAR race is 4 hours long. So it's a lot of data, and that's for one channel. Now, the ECU on the car, which is an electronic control unit that does fuel injection for the car, it records about 250 channels. So you're getting 250 channels at up to 100 hertz. Some of them are actually logged at 500 hertz. And from that standpoint, we've got a huge amount of data every event. And keep in mind, Hendrick supplies engines for 12 NASCAR teams, so multiply that amount of data for one team times 12, and that's the data that we generate on a weekly basis. And that's just for the race event. There's actually probably 9 or 10 times that the car goes out on the track, and every time the car is turned on, this data logger starts running. So it's 100 points per second whenever the car is switched on. Now, in actuality, when the race event is going on, this is the data you get access to. So you've got a ton of data being collected on the car. It's being offloaded basically to flash storage on the ECU unit. And then when the race is over and you pull the car back in the garage and turn the car off, you plug into the car with an Ethernet connection and you download that data. But during the event, this is really what you get. So you don't really know what the fuel pressure is. You don't know what the fuel status of the fuel cell is. You don't even know driver speed except for what you might see on TV. In fact, a lot of the guys on the pit box, people don't know this, they'll watch TV because it's one of the best sources of information. So when you're watching the race at home, you're getting some of the same data that the NASCAR teams rely on in terms of RPM, how much brake they're applying, how much gas, what their lap times are. We don't really have this proprietary stream of data from NASCAR that gives us a whole lot more insight. So the main problem with this one is, how do you make decisions on data that's occurring real time that you don't have access to? And so one of the ways you get around that is you kind of have to fabricate data, and you fabricate it based off past data. Go ahead. Yeah, great question. He said, is that a NASCAR rule or a hardware limitation? It's a NASCAR rule. Yeah. They're talking about race telemetry in the future, and they do offload race telemetry, and that's what you get through a TV feed. But as what's available to the teams, this is it. You can get some feedback from the driver. He might tell you, okay, I lifted a little bit early in that corner, or here's what my oil pressure is reading right now, or my oil temp and water temp. Sometimes they'll make that kind of declaration over the radio, but you're not getting any of that telemetry data, and it's based on rules. So if you don't have access to the data, but you've got to make decisions on the data, what do you do? And a concrete example of this is fuel in the car. In case you didn't know it, there's not a fuel gauge in the car. So at any point during the race, the driver doesn't really know, okay, have I got a quarter of a tank left, 3/4 of a tank, am I full? Did they get it full? He doesn't know. And so you have to use past events and past history, and you actually weigh the fuel cans when they dump in the car, because they won't even let you know how many gallons are in the fuel can. NASCAR is controlled from the standpoint that they want it to be a series where even the teams that are smaller budget have similar competitive advantage. And so one of the things they want to guard against is fuel additives. So when they bring you the fuel cans full of fuel, they're actually sealed. And you might take the seal off and then plug the fuel can in, but you don't know how much fuel is in there. So what you do is weigh it. And you do a calculation from fuel weight, basically the density of the fuel, to determine how many gallons you put in the car. And so the whole time the race is playing out, you're guessing how much fuel is in the fuel cell, how close am I to running out. And it's also part dramatization. You know, they kind of play that up on TV. You know, is he going to run out? Okay, a screen white checker, 3 more laps, will he make it? And it gives them something to talk about and adds a lot to the dramatization of the event. It makes life tough as an engineer to say, okay, I think he's going to run out before the race is over. We should pit. And so one of the ways to get around that is we try to take data that from past events and build a machine learning model that we can then feed in data we do get from NASCAR in terms of lap time, who the driver is, maybe his running position. And with those inputs that we can get from NASCAR, which are basic high-level inputs of how the car is performing on a lap-by-lap basis, can we turn around and predict how much fuel we use every lap and then kind of keep a running sum of that amount of fuel used each lap and then determine, okay, we think there's 12.2 gallons in the cell. Two more laps later, we think there's 11.5. And it's based off a machine learning model. So go into detail a little bit more on that aspect. We take this data that we have, and there's a couple data sets here. One is the data we get from NASCAR, and that's provided through a JSON feed. And so that typically covers things like current run position of the car, what was the car's last lap time, when did he pit, relative position to other competitors in the field. And then we have past data that we pull from that ECU that has that high fidelity 100 hertz data log. And that does have the amount of fuel used at any point in time and the amount of fuel used per second, per lap. We have that high fidelity data set, it's just we don't get it until after the race is over. So we take this data and we kind of mash it up into a merged data set, and then we feed that merged data set into a machine learning model. Now, a little side note on this, a lot of times in data science, one of the things you need to watch out for is a response variable that sometimes is unbounded. And so in this case, we'll talk about basically the same engineering type parameter, lap per gallon or fuel used per lap. They're really the same metric, but one's an inverse of the other. And the thing you run into is when you talk about lap per gallon, and you might have seen it in some of the newer cars, when you get out of the gas, it goes to 99. It's really going to infinite. They just show you 99 because at that point, it's really not a factor. So when you start talking about lap per gallon, when the driver gets out of the gas, lap per gallon shoots to infinity. It's kind of difficult to make a machine learning model where your response variable goes from zero to infinity. It's tough to capture that. But if you take lap per gallon, you flip it and do the inverse, which is basically gallons of fuel used per lap, its range is zero to one, basically. So we're bounding that response variable by something that's a little bit easier to capture than zero to infinity. And it makes a big difference here. So when you're thinking about machine learning models and what your response variable is, be careful if your response variable is unbounded, or think of maybe there's a creative way through a Gaussian transformation, or maybe you want to use some other transformation to get it into an aspect where you can kind of control a little bit better. So we take all that data and we're basically forming a model of what is our fuel consumption based on a particular metric on the track that we can measure from NASCAR. And then we're going to take that and turn around to broadcast that into basically a dashboard. And that dashboard is fed, it's an ASP.NET web application. It's fed from data where we're predicting how much fuel is used because we're asking Azure for the amount of fuel used at that particular point. And then this is a particular dashboard that teams on the pit box will use to get an idea of the fuel consumption or fuel state of the car at any point during the race. So it's taking data that you don't have access to, fabricating it the best you can, having some error checking in there, having a machine learning model, and then presenting it to the view so that the guy at the very end can make a decision and act upon it. So it's basically creating data you can't get a hold of. So we've been pretty successful with this. This is an example of, from this standpoint, kind of error in the model. The black kind of transparent dots are like actual data points from this standpoint. And then a blue is just basically a blind fit of how well the model fits, and you can see it here. It's basically centered around zero error. You're not going to be perfect. There are going to be some laps where maybe you changed your running position or you jockeyed position with someone else and your fuel consumption goes up or down, but as a general rule of thumb, it kind of washes out over a 400 lap race. So that's kind of our second problem. We've got the photo problem. We've got data that we want, but we can't really get to problem. And we solve both those with solutions that leverage machine learning and Azure. To kind of touch on the idea of Azure, this is kind of a boilerplate slide deck that Azure provides, but I want to touch on a few areas that we really play ball in and focus in, and it might spark some conversation or maybe you guys have some experience with this. We do leverage machine learning a pretty good amount. We do a lot in Machine Learning Studio, and we'll hit that through REST APIs and ask it for information, get an answer back, and act on that information. If you haven't messed with machine learning, it's got classification models, it's got regression models, neural nets. You can implement R code and put R code in there if you want to customize your own R code. Really, the amount of flexibility you have with their machine learning model is pretty awesome. And the main point here is that it's got scale to it. So if you say, well, you know, I'm getting fuel consumption for one car, I'd like to move that up to all 43 cars, you can kind of scale that up and let them handle the hardware side and the, the implementation of the machine learning model, and then you're just implementing an API call 43 times instead of one. Or you might do a batch API call. We've dabbled and messed with the big data and HD Insight and Hadoop and Spark. I mean, there's a ton of buzzwords in this space, and it does change a lot. And it's very difficult to stay on top of the cutting edge unless that's your full-time job. We do have a lot of that engine data I mentioned that's collected at about 100 hertz, 100 times per second. And it just gets to grow pretty significant. As a side note, one race file, the McLaren software restores it in binary format, so we have to extract it out into CSV. And one car, one event is about a 500 meg CSV file. So there's a lot of data we're messing with, and that's one team. If you say, well, we've got 12 teams and now 36 races, you can imagine that data set grows pretty large. We do a lot of web app development and host a decent amount of our ASP.NET apps on Azure and scale it up if we need to. The beauty about this is it provides the opportunity, especially in racing, where it's a weekly cadence. And you might say, well, the Sunday afternoon of the event, we want to make sure everything's operational and we've got the scale we need. So you can go in there and tune and ask for more resources, and you pay by the minute. So we might go in and say, well, the race starts at 1 o'clock, at 12:30, I'm gonna ramp up to 8 or 10 instances, and the race ends at 4:30, I ramp that back to a maintenance one node. And so we can basically pay by the minute more during the race and then turn that off so that we're not investing in that hardware that's running 24/7. So we do a decent amount of that. Do a lot of data storage and kind of touches on that data we collect on the car. It's getting into a format that we can query it and ask questions of that data and archive it for later use and determine trends and anomaly detection. And you can feed that back into the machine learning model, and it's really a holistic approach where if you'll get your data in an area in Azure where you can work with it, it opens up a lot of avenues. And then the last one is the virtual machines. And I kind of want to expand on this a little bit. We do have a deal with them where we use what's called a high-performance cluster. And so the idea of a high-performance cluster is you're asking Azure for a multitude of machines that are going to crunch numbers for you. And so one of the things in NASCAR that you care about is the aerodynamics of the car, and one of the ways to figure that out is either wind tunnel time or what they call CFD, and that stands for computational fluid dynamics. It's a fancy engineering term to basically say, hey, this is what airflow does when it flows over the car. It might get to the front of the car, and because it's kind of mismatched there, maybe the airflow breaks and becomes turbulent. Well, CFD will tell you that. The problem with CFD is it's very computationally intensive. It's computational fluid dynamics. And so when you start looking at the amount of computing power you need to solve a CFD solution on a whole car, it grows pretty quickly to the point you've got two options. You can either buy your own servers, and that's typically 600 to 1,000 cores, which probably runs you about $500,000, somewhere around there. Or you can go on Azure and ask them for virtual machines. And if you know anything about CFD, CFD is a distributed node computing platform where you've got a main computer that does basically the handing out of the jobs, and then you offload bits and pieces of that computation to multiple machines. And for it to be performant, you really need all those machines to be able to talk directly to each other's memory. And so in a typical network-attached machine, that's really not an option where this computer can talk to that computer's memory directly. So we ask for particular machines that have what's called InfiniBand. It's kind of an industry standard developed by Intel that allows one machine to talk to another machine's memory directly, and you get that latency of 2 microseconds, 3 microseconds. So Azure offers that. We take advantage of it. And if we need a CFD answer, we'll spool up 1,000 cores in the cloud, pay for that amount of time, maybe it's an hour and a half, and then we'll shut it off and stop paying. And whenever we need a job, we'll fire that up, run that job, turn it off, fire that up, run that job, turn it off. And that way you're not paying for really expensive equipment that sometimes is sitting there idle. So we take advantage of the virtual machines. So that kind of gives you an overview of some of the areas. There's a whole lot more areas we could dive into here, but that's the main five that we've really kind of put in place over the last year. And to expand on that CFD idea, I do have a little chart here. So this is an example of some output you get from CFD. This obviously is a CAD model of a NASCAR car. Specifically, this is a GM branded car, so it's a Chevrolet car. And the idea is that you induce, from a digital standpoint or an engineering standpoint, a stream of air, and then you're wanting to know, what does that air do when it hits the car? Which way does that air flow? When does it break turbulent and become kind of they call this kind of laminar flow, where it's moving in one direction and it's not kind of mixed up and turbulent. Where does it become turbulent? Where does it break off? Where does this actual bead of air go up and come over? And the color plots determine maybe pressure at a particular point or velocity of the airflow. And so when you're trying to run these simulations, the larger the CAD model, the more computation you have to do, and that necessitates the need for something like a cloud solution. If you're doing CFD on maybe just a garden hose, for instance, you might not need that much computing power because it's pretty small in its actual cross-sectional area and what you're working with. But when you start talking about a car, this is usually defined a number of cells, which are basically the patch size that that CAD model is made up with. I think a car like this might run, don't hold me to this, but I want to say about 130 million cells, somewhere around there. And so to get an answer, you need computational power, and we can either buy it or rent it. So we choose at this point to rent it. So from that standpoint, that's kind of an idea of where we stand. I think they threw this slide in on me from the standpoint of some ideas to get, I guess, for the pro resources. If you have more questions about Azure, I'm sure you can go to some of these and get an idea for what Azure's all about, how you can start to learn more, a little bit more about machine learning and the high-performance computing and image recognition and all the things they offer. I'd encourage you to get in there and dig around. They do have a lot of resources, especially if you already have an Azure account. You do yourself an injustice if you're not at least looking at what all's out there. So if you got some feedback, I'd love to hear it through, I guess, an anonymous type post. At this point, if you've got any questions, I'd love to take them. Maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the content. Yeah, go ahead. The question was, how much of that data does NASCAR let us use for race simulations that are not at the racetrack? So like, yeah, during the, say during the week? Yeah, at this point, NASCAR doesn't put any limitation into what you can really do with that data and the simulations you can run. We do have dynos at the engine department that can actually run a full live simulation of the track, so they can run 500-600 miles in a row. And we'll take some of this data we collect and we'll transform it into a lap of that driver, and we'll run that lap, and it'll actually simulate pitting and that downshifting and upshifting, getting back up to speed. So we use that data to basically recreate that live event at the shop in case we had a failure and need to learn something from it. So yeah, they don't have any regulations on it. Yeah, anybody else? Yeah, go ahead. Question was, how long do we keep the data? We don't throw away anything. So they came along with fuel injection in 2012. We've got it's called Atlas is the program that collects the data. We've got every Atlas file every time the car was cranked up since 2012. So we'll archive it and put it in a different location, but in terms of what we have, we rarely delete anything. Yeah. Anybody else? What did I do? I went to, how did I get there? Yeah, great question. So I grew up in Charlotte, which helps a lot because they're located in Charlotte. I went to school at NC State, if you're familiar with that, in Raleigh. Yeah, you went there. Got a bachelor's there and a master's, and then I sent out letters. I said, I don't really know anybody in NASCAR. I'll send out letters to everybody and hope I'll get a phone call. And I didn't really know what I was doing, so I sent letters to all the crew chiefs. And that's probably the last person you want to send a letter to unless you know them personally, because they're just super busy and they don't have a lot. So I ended up coming back home and working for a small engine shop that builds engines for basically people that race in a smaller series like K&N series or local Saturday night racers. And kept calling and asking around and finally got an interview and got hired at another race team, Penske Racing, and then kind of worked my way up from there and then transferred over to Hendrick back in 2012. So. Yeah, did you have one? Yeah.
So when those pictures are taken, those are stored on what? Just on camera? Are they immediately uploaded to the cloud somewhere?
Yeah.
And then what's your concern about security standpoint? Are you keeping photos?
Yeah, great question. His question was, when the photo is taken, basically what happens after that? You know, where does it go? And is there a security concern? So from that standpoint, the photographer will take the camera, and usually they have Wi-Fi to name cameras. Or they'll pop out the memory card, maybe connect it to a cell phone and push it up. But it basically travels back down to a local server at the track. At that point, there's basically replication going on. Our guys at the track are connected to that local server and can pull that data down from our server. It ends up getting pushed up to Azure for the image recognition. And so it is transmitted multiple times throughout the track from that standpoint. From a security standpoint, I would probably punt on that to our IT guy and ask him what he thinks. I know a lot of our stuff is hardwired in, but there is some Wi-Fi issues going on. I'm not aware of any security concerns, but we can definitely, he's actually here, we can follow up with him after if you'd like to. So his follow-up question was, the data pulled from the, basically the data logger, is it shared amongst all competitors, or is it basically?
The GMT,
yeah.
Or is that just
Hendrick? Yeah. Yeah, so you bring up a great point. It gets a little sticky. Hendrick Motorsports does supply engines for other GM teams, so we have to be careful in terms of the Stewart-Haas data. It's not openly and freely always available to other Hendrick Motorsports teams. It's kind of Stewart-Haas's data. And there's a fine line between the engine shop being a supplier to all the Chevrolet teams, and there is a, I guess you could call it a conflict of interest since we do have our own teams as well. So they're pretty strict in terms of that data flow, and it's not just open source, fair game for everyone. Yeah. Good.
Maybe you can complete that question. It'd be important to maybe say that it's more raw data at the track time, and anybody can see that car and take pictures of the car. And where the security layer comes in is when you're in Azure.
Yeah. Well, I think two things there. I think when he's talking about the ECU data, that's pulled off with a hardwire connection. And then that's not, if it's Stewart-Haas data, it's not shared with HMS teams per se. Even though the engine department has access to that data, there's an agreement in place that the engine shop basically acts like a supplier to both organizations at that point. So to kind of touch on that, but in terms of the photos, anybody that has a paid photographer at the track can take those photos, but once we take them, they are pushed up to Azure and become ours at that point. And that's just internal to HMS only, or Hendrick Motorsports. Yeah. Go ahead.
When do you think they're going to use race day telemetry? You'll be able to get that.
Right. Data? Yeah, I talked with a NASCAR guy, and they're also heavily involved with Microsoft, and Microsoft has come out with some neat technology on their side in terms of laser measurement systems and their Hawkeye system, which is like a camera type recording system. I think they're running to not having a definite time frame, and they don't really say, hey, this is when you're going to get that data. We talk about telemetry, and they know we'd like it. I think they're trying to make sure that, if I had to guess, when it's done right, and there's not a time frame at this particular point for that. Yeah. Yeah, there are. Yeah, good point. There used to be analog, you know, hard gauges in the dash, and they do have now a digital display that is collecting data and giving feedback to the driver, and it's a little more advanced. When they open up the telemetry pipeline, I'm not sure. Our hope is that we've prepared and gotten to that point that when they do allow us to have it, it can be a performance advantage from our standpoint to be able to consume it and extract value out of it. Yeah. Go ahead. Well, from the engine standpoint, the engine shop provides what they call a tuner. He's a technician that would go in and provide support to those teams. And he interfaces with the engine, he works on the engine, he pulls data off the engine. So the engine shop gets that data automatically. Where it's sticky is that data stays in the engine shop and doesn't transmit to the car side. So the engine shop has access to all those teams. Can you repeat that, please?
How much of the
data between the teams and Hendrick Motorsports do we share? Amongst the four cars we have? Quite a lot. We have a common database system where setups of the cars are put in, maybe spring rate or other parameters of the car. They're entered so that all four teams can kind of look at each other's data. Those guys use OneNote a lot. There's a guy on the 88 team, his OneNote notebook is 90 gigs. So in terms of sharing data back and forth, they do a good job through OneNote, Skype, a lot of stuff in the cloud, OneDrive, some stuff we host on-prem. And so in terms of sharing amongst the four teams, they do a pretty good job at it. And you kind of need to Otherwise, you have four teams that are all trying the same thing, and it doesn't scale too well when you try to. Our goal is to have all four cars in the chase, so you'd like to have data across all four teams shared if you find something good. So it occurs pretty frequently. Anybody else? Right. It's a great question. Yeah, his question was, when you get into the chase, do things kind of get a little more sandboxed? And from that standpoint, the chase is a big difference. It's such a high-stress, high-profile environment where you've got three races to prove yourself, and then there's reset. And so the best I can tell, and the meetings I'm involved with, the interaction with the team, they still share. You know, and a lot of NASCAR is set up so that the driver still has a lot of input into the car. And the professional athlete aspect of the driver and his individual skill set shines. And so from that standpoint, a car set up this particular way for, say, Jimmy, and a car set up this particular way for Chase, you could set the same car up for both guys, and they might handle completely different depending on their driving style. They might have different lap times. So sometimes it's not a direct translation. But if they do find speed or find an area that shows significant improvement, they'll share that and let other teams know about it, you know, even though it's a very competitive environment. Yeah. Anybody else? Different in terms of what?
Well, it's not
just segments. Yeah. His question was, are road courses any kind of different preparation or setup compared to just a round track like Martinsville? The neat thing about all the tracks we go to is when you're talking about a race car on the track, you'd like to drive the car at wide open throttle all the time. And so the difference between the tracks usually equates to lap time and probably gross speed of the car. So when you start talking about a road course, you definitely turn different directions, and they might have a little bit of setup difference in the car, and a lot of times those will be a completely different car manufactured for that event. So from a mechanical car standpoint, it is a totally different entity that they're taking to the track. From a preparation standpoint, in terms of data and photography, a lot of that gets washed out because the different course being longer just equates to a different lap time at that point. And so with the lap time being different, your fuel consumption is different, but because the track stays the same from year one to year two to year three to year end, you can take that machine learning model and apply it forward. Now, if they went in and said, okay, we're gonna take the road course and shorten it by 0.3 mile or make it a mile longer, then we'd have to do a lot of retraining of the model from that standpoint, from the fuel side, to take advantage and to be able to capture that change in length of the track. But as long as they don't do that, barring a crazy rule change where the aerodynamics of the car change completely, usually prep is about the same from year to year for each track. Yeah. Yeah.
Is the workflow for the images and all the telemetry coming off the engine fast enough that during practice you guys are getting to see all this data real time? Or is it something where after practice you finally get to take the pictures?
Yeah. So for the photographs, the question was the workflow of the consumption of the photo and the data, can it happen real time or is there a delay? A lot of times for the photos, they're taking so many photos, you have to wait for the photo to transmit to the server at the track, transmit up to Azure, get an answer and come back. The nice thing about that, even though there is a little bit of latency there, is in the heat of the moment, the race engineer really doesn't have time or the opportunity to make an adjustment on the car at that point. So they'll run the car, they'll try their kind of queued up changes that they want to try to see if it changes lap time. Then after the practice and they have some downtime, they'll consume photos, see what they look like, and queue up a new batch of changes for the next time they go out on the track. So they don't really have the opportunity to look at the photos, say, bring it in immediately, let's change that particular area. They've kind of had that area queued out.
Are you guys coordinating the photos to the point where they can line it up to actual changes that were made?
The question was, can you take the photos and the changes made on the photos and kind of correlate the two to faster lap time? And a lot of times you can, especially when you're talking about the gap of the splitter or how much is sealed up on the side. Yeah, if you can get that sealed up more or change the aerodynamics from that standpoint, it does equate to better lap time. There are some areas that are a little bit vague depending on the track. Like sometimes you'll spend a decent amount of time not around another car. And then during the race, if you're close to another car, the aerodynamics come into play and it's hard to get a handle on that. But
Are you associated with pictures taken in that timestamp to?
I see what you're saying. Yeah, do those photos influence that particular change as you go forward? Yeah, they'll look at those changes in that downtime and then queue up the next setup for the next practice. So, yeah. Sorry, I misunderstood you there for a minute. Anybody else? Yeah. Would you? Yeah. So his question was: is there a diminishing return as you? Correct me if I'm wrong. As you add more cores, you're not getting the same amount back as you continue to add more cores. Yeah. We've seen that it is for us particularly. It's almost linear. So if you want to solve the car in 2 hours, and you say, well, I've got to have an answer in an hour, if you'll double the amount of processors, you'll knock that down. It's pretty close. The thing you do run into is a side note, it can get expensive, you know. So you start talking about if you want to scale, you better make sure you talk to accounting because it's going to add up pretty quickly. But we, as a side note, we do run into the comparison between it and the Winning Tunnel. Azure, I think we probably spend, let's just call 1,000 cores, 125 to 150 an hour maybe, you know, which is expensive. The wind tunnel time is usually $2,500 to $4,000 an hour. So while it is expensive, it's a lot less than wind tunnel time. So, you know, right at night. Yeah.
Where is the budget for the tech now compared to like 5 or 6 years ago? Like, what kind of stuff? Do you see this as a continuing cost that will just continue to grow over time? Or
yeah. Right. His question was, in terms of budgetary amounts and allocation, basically to Azure and compute and digital assets, and, you know, there's been a lot of change in even headcount over the last 5 to 10 years. You know, Hendrick Motorsports is a heavily engineering-driven company, and I think we have, I think the numbers are 80 engineers on staff, so we're over 10% of our workforce is engineers. And so we allocate a lot of time and resources and money to application development, consumption of data, analyzation of data, trying to use that. But what we found is it can really pay off. One of the things we run into is with an engine shop that supplies 12 teams with engines, if you find an issue in one engine and it propagates to all 12, sometimes you run out of time to be able to fix that with the cadence of a week-to-week-to-week event. But in terms of the actual budgetary spending, I'm pretty confident we're spending more money in cloud solutions and IT. I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that has gone up some. If I had to guess, it would continue to go up. There is a scale with the cloud. It tends to get cheaper if you stay constant with your hardware. So we're using A8 or A9 machines. I think the depreciation in terms of what it costs you for that compute power is like 3% maybe. So if you said, we don't want any faster processors, we just want what we've got, that cost would continue to go down. But even more importantly, that is managing it. If you turn on the CFD cluster at 125 an hour and you never turned it off, it's going to eat you out of house and home, you know. So if you can manage and say, hey, I'm going to spool it up for an hour and then turn it off and pay by the minute, that's way more effective than being lackadaisical with your allocation, if that makes sense. You know, that's a good question. Do we spend more on tech and less on traditional engineering? I would say probably no. You still got to validate anything done in CFD or anything done in terms of the digital creation of machine learning. It still needs to be validated with real-world experience and that there is a correlation there. And that's one of the problems we run into is it's difficult sometimes to correlate CFD with on-track performance. And so we still spend a ton of money trying to find that correlation. So unfortunately, I don't know that I see costs really going down. They seem to be going up. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay, thank you.